Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, are you ready to head into the book nook?
Sure, Patrick.
Great. Let me just open the door here.
Ooh, man. The book nook smells pretty ripe.
Wow, you're right. It smells like someone left an Iron Maiden down here and it went bad.
Okay, Patrick, so have you been spending a lot of time reading lately, you know, given that you've been home all the time?
Yes, Jim, I have been reading a lot. And I read a lot anyway, but I don't know, you know, these are unsettling, turbulent, troubling times. And I think for a lot of people, that leads to them maybe not sleeping as well, you know, resting, doing things like that. And so, as always, I tend to read a lot either before bed and sometimes during the night. But yes, I've been devouring books at probably an even higher rate. And one book that I've almost made it through, I don't know if you have any of these kind of books in your life, Jim, where you try to read it a couple times and for whatever reason you can't get through it. Mm-hmm. There's a huge book called Infinite Jest. Anyone out there who knows this book, it's like almost 1,000 pages plus footnotes. Twice I tried to read it, but during this pandemic, I've actually almost done with that book. So it's going to be a monumental achievement when I finally finish that.
Oh, good. Well, good for you.
Thank you. It was hard going.
That's good. Yeah. You know, everybody needs a project. That's what I tell people when they ask me why I'm growing this beard. You know, everybody needs a project, and you found a good one. So that's a good thing. Okay, so this show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we have done this theme before, which is Patrick's Book Nook, which is where you talk about recent rock books or music books that you have read, right?
Yep.
And we have theme music for it, right?
I love it.
Yeah.
Yes.
To the book nook. Look, we have books. And over there, another book. And right over there, it's Kindle.
All right, fantastic. Who put together that theme music? Mike, how did you do that?
Mike Wagner actually came up with the drums and the guitar and the melody and everything like that, and I just put a few words to it and did a little keyboard noodling. So together, Wagner Foster put that one together.
It's fantastic. So
it's fun.
Okay, so what books do you have for us today?
Well, Jim, I've got three books I want to talk about. Yeah, really quick.
Not Infinite Jest, though.
not Infinite Jest. Although this one here, it's called 1966, The Year the Decade Exploded, written by John Savage. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, Jim, or if anyone out there is. He wrote another book, which in my opinion is the definitive text on punk rock in the UK. And that book was called England's Dreaming, Anarchy, Sex Pistols, Punk Rock and Beyond. So if you really want the history of how it all really happened, and John Savage was there, go get that book. But this new one, it's new to me. It was released in 2018. 1966, The Year the Decade Exploded, is really an incredible history, not only musically, but also socially, of the events of this incredible year when so many interesting records came out, so many changes took place. It's really quite an incredible year. And just to give you an example, he breaks this book down into 12 chapters, one per month. And some of them, like Chapter 3, Ballad of the Green Berets, Vietnam War in America, you know, it talks about Sergeant Barry Sadler's song. It talks about how the war impacted culture in America, how it was seen in the UK. So that's just one example of what he takes on. June, for example, I'll Be Your Mirror, Velvet Underground, Andy Warhol's America. Land of 1,000 Dances is July, Tamla, Soul, and the March Against Fear. So he goes really through all kinds of things. It's a very, very beautiful book. There's a chapter near the end on the Beach Boys, which is quite incredible. But to be able to take a look at music, the way it impacts the culture and the way the culture and current events impacted the music, it's a much bigger project than just sort of running down, here's a list of all the cool songs and albums that took place in 66. So very, very, very good book. Highly recommend that one. It's a little deeper, a little tougher, you know, than just sort of reading a regular old music book. But I found it to be very interesting. I learned a lot about the way the Vietnam War impacted America, the UK, and the 60s. I was too young. This is the year I was born, as a matter of fact, 66. So all those things that were happening, you know, we sort of learned about secondhand. But this is a really great history. And man, to think about all the Motown records that were being created during that year, at the same time Good Vibrations was being created and the Velvet Underground, and Dylan was on his final electric phase before the motorcycle accident. It's just, it's really incredible.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's not one of the years that just sort of like immediately pops up when people think about like sort of great years in music. Or, you know, I think in the 60s, you look at 1964 and probably 1967 and 1969. Yep. 68 was, you know, obviously the year of the assassinations and all of that. Yeah. And then 69 with Woodstock and sort of the, you know, America really sort of in transition there and everything. But yeah, you don't hear about 66 a whole lot, right?
No, and, you really don't.
That was the year of Revolver. So I like, I always mark, you know, I tend to mark a lot of these years in the 60s by which Beatles album came out, right? So that was your Revolver. So obviously, you know, there were things happening. People were opening themselves up to new experiences. You can tell that through music, right? And then...
Totally.
So, and Pet Sounds was that year as well, right? So
Good Vibrations, Pet Sounds. And the Velvet Underground recorded the first Velvet Underground album in 1966. It wasn't released until 1967 because... Right. The label sat on it for a long time, but that's really when VU was at their sort of pure incarnation with Nico and John Cale and Lou Reed and everything.
And then, as you mentioned, like, I mean, Motown was like maybe at its peak right then.
I mean, you know, if you look
Motown
at
the period was the mid 60s, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when Norman Whitfield started producing the Temptations. That's when they expanded sort of out of the original building to make a little more room, you know, by buying some of those things. Just, you know, it was just incredible. All those things that were happening around that time. You know, there was also the Black Panther movement was taking place at that time. There was a tremendous amount of civil rights turmoil. It's when Martin Luther King Jr. really started becoming a public figure, you know, for equality and things like that. So it's really kind of an incredible year.
A lot of stuff sort of bubbling up to the surface, right?
Yeah.
But probably good lessons to be learned in that for today, right? Are there probably some interesting parallels, right, to a lot of things that we're going through even in 2020?
Totally. I mean, reading some of it, it's kind of shocking how some of this stuff has been happening for a long time in our country.
Okay. So you recommend this book?
Highly recommend it. It's a good cerebral look at, again, the impact beyond just, you know, someone putting a record on a turntable and listening to it.
Right, right. All right, cool.
I find it hard to believe you don't know the beauty you are. But if you don't, let me be your eyes, a hand to your darkness, so you won't be afraid. When you think the night has in your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you are blind. Please put down your hands, 'cause I see you.
So that's one I read that I really enjoyed. Now, I got to tell you, completely shifting gears.
Okay.
This is a really fun book that I found on Kindle and read probably like in a day. It's a pretty short book. The book is called What Does This Button Do? An Autobiography. And it's written by Bruce Dickinson, who is most famously known as the lead singer for Iron Maiden.
Right.
For many, many years. And this book is not really an autobiography in the sense of like Bruce is not blowing the lid off everything that happened, you know. It's really more of like a collection of anecdotes, really amazing anecdotes that happened to this guy. But Bruce Dickinson is not only just a singer, right? So he's a licensed pilot who eventually flew like this 747 on tour with Iron Maiden, which is kind of incredible. He's a world-class fencer. So he won world competitions in fencing throughout his entire life. He would be like, you know, recording in the studio, and when the vocal parts were done, he would go to like this fencing thing, and he would fly all over the world to compete in these really high level fencing competitions, which is kind of incredible. He's written three screenplays, like sort of zombie stories that have all been made into movies. He's a beer entrepreneur. I don't know if you remember, Jim, when we tasted the Iron Maiden beer. He was behind that. And of course, you know, he was the lead singer of Iron Maiden, and they sold like millions of records, and you know, he had some big hits. So it's a really funny, fun book about a guy who's, I guess he's like 65 now. He's lived like 12 people's lives, it seems like, with all the stuff that he's done. It's really, really a fun book to read. And Bruce Dickinson, this Bruce Dickinson, has nothing to do with that famous Saturday Night Live sketch.
Right.
About the cowbell.
Yeah.
It's a totally different Bruce Dickinson.
Right.
Yeah, I kept wanting to get to that part where he talks about that. He doesn't even mention it in the book because it had nothing to do with him.
No,
it's a totally other Bruce Dickinson, which I never knew.
Yes. Yeah. Producer. Right.
Yeah.
Something else. Yeah. Completely different. But what you're saying here, I'm always amazed by people who have that kind of ambition to be great at various things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. It's like, you know, I have the day job. I have this podcast. But other than that, I'm like pretty good at like watching TV, you know?
Yeah.
Drinking whiskey, right? Like I can do those things pretty well, but I'm not world class in anything, right?
I mean, it's incredible. He also had cancer, throat cancer, and he's overcome that. It's just, it's amazing. Like you said, how do you not only find the energy to do all these things, but also the motivation?
Right.
Because being an airline pilot is extremely difficult. It's not like learning how to drive a stick, man. It's a little more complicated than
I mean,
that.
That's a whole career. That is a whole career to do that. I think it's important to emphasize people. This is not like those hobbyists who take some flying lessons and learn how to fly like a Piper Cub or that kind of thing.
Mm-mm.
This is like he learned how to fly major jet aircraft, right? And did he work for an airline or something? Like
he did. Yes. Yeah. After one Iron Maiden tour, he just wasn't doing that much. And he was like, I'm just going to go to this British airline, like a commercial airline, and get a job with them. And he did it. Just, most people would want to take some downtime after a heavy metal tour of the world. But no, not Bruce. And so, yeah, he worked for this airline just as like a regular guy, you know? And, there's funny stories of fans of Iron Maiden, you know, who were on commercial flights and saw him as like the pilot and kind of freaked out. But it's totally amazing. Totally amazing.
So it's funny because we just had an episode, a couple episodes recently where we talked about the movie This is Spinal Tap. And, you know, obviously the big joke there is sort of like, oh, how dumb these musicians are, you know, they're dumb and self-absorbed and self-important and all that kind of stuff. But the sense I'm getting from this book is that is not at all reflective of Bruce Dickinson.
Not in any way, even though some of the incidents that happened to Iron Maiden, Spinal Tap might have taken a couple of those incidents, you know, the things with Eddie, their giant mascot not working and, you know, all these little things that they would do at these giant heavy metal concerts. But yeah, totally not the case with him. But he has such a good sense of humor about the whole thing. Okay. Like, you know, he sort of sees the absurdity and the fact that he's made so much money doing these things. And the fencing part to me kind of blows my mind, too, because it's extremely difficult and esoteric sport with all these bizarre rules, and you know, just ticking somebody's chest with the point of your sword is like how you get points. It's crazy.
My daughter did fencing for about a year or so when she was a kid. She took fencing lessons, and I think she ended up only doing like one competition, and then she kind of lost interest because she's not a competitive person. I think that was sort of the end of it.
Well, yeah,
but here's what I learned about fencing from that year. It's a mental sport. It's a mental and like strategic sport. It's all about like position and thinking about how and when you have that opportunity to make that touch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
that opening.
I mean, obviously there's some athleticism to it as well, but it's like super mental, like a little game of chess that's happening right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So again, falling into that idea, like this is a really smart guy.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And again, just the motivation and dedication to stick with something like that really kind of blew my mind when I was reading this book. So you can find it on Kindle for real cheap for a couple bucks if you have a Kindle. And there's copies out there. It's really a fun read. Now, I will tell you on the other side of it, it again, not a traditional autobiography. So there's like zero really about his personal life after he gets out of his teen years. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about his schooling and stuff like that. And there's no real discussion of sort of the infighting that led him to leave Iron Maiden for a period and come back. It's just like things weren't working out with Maiden. You know, so obviously there was a whole lot more going on than is there. So you're not going to get that kind of stuff. He doesn't, you know, backstab or right. throw anybody under the bus or anything like that. Very few specifics as far as that goes, but a lot of really cool, funny anecdotes.
All right. That's cool. All right. That sounds like a good find.
It's definitely worth the read.
All right. Yeah. All right, cool.
I'd like to talk about is the book that probably surprised me the most. So I go through the Kindle and I usually just sort it by, hey, give me all music books and, you know, give me autobiographies and then give me history, right? And I'll just scroll through and see what's cheap or what I can get on my Kindle Unlimited deal, you know, for nothing. And a book I found that I had very, very low expectations for. I was not expecting too much out of this book. It is called Big City Cat, My Life in Folk Rock. And the author is Steve Forbit.
Oh, okay.
And so many people know him from his song Romeo's Tune, which was a hit for him on his very, I think, second album, but very early in his career. Yeah. And that song, I think, went top five, right, Jim? It was a very, very popular song.
It was a big hit in the 70s.
Yeah. Know. 78, but, something like that.
But kind of forgotten today, which is unfortunate. So yeah, it's a really, really great pop song.
And that album that it comes from, Jackrabbit Slim, is a very excellent album too. So he's born in Mississippi. Eventually he makes his way after some, you know, bands in high school and college that a lot of people had. He makes his way up to New York City. And this is 1977, right around the time when punk rock is exploding. And you know, he's going out and he's watching the Ramones and the Talking Heads play their first shows. And he's right in the middle of that entire scene, hanging out with those people. Hmm. He's being managed by Danny Fields, who was also the manager of the Ramones. At one time, Danny Fields was managing Steve Forbit and the Ramones. Those were his two bands.
I had no idea.
It's so interesting that he was there during all this time and he was playing shows. Hilly Crystal liked him. So he got a lot of opening slots at CBGB and played there a million times. Like, he's part of that scene, and that's where he was when Romeo's Tune sort of came out and took him into another, you know, sort of another stratosphere. But I'll tell you what I found so interesting about this book. It's so extremely refreshing. Unlike the Bruce Dickinson book, there's a lot of detail about Steve Forbit's life. And I highlighted something here that I thought he's just so honest about how his career went and what it took for him to get to make a living at music. There were times when he was just going to quit altogether. He put out many albums after Jackrabbit Slim. He never had another hit. Right. And, you know, he talks about how much work he put into writing these songs and how he labored over it and how the record company wanted him to create a second hit. And he tried every single thing and it just never happened for him. But here's a quote I found very, very interesting. He's out on the road trying to make it as a solo singer-songwriter. Eventually, he was just driving around in his car with a guitar. He wasn't making enough money to really have a full band with him at the time. He says he had twin boys at home, and his wife was raising twin boys while he was out on the road. He says, quote, I was running myself ragged and crazy, trying to pay our bills and trying to meet the demands of a career in popular music. When you're on top, the job of a musician, although stressful, is made as comfortable as possible, and it pays incredibly well. On the less successful levels, you do a lot of work all over the place, but can soon wind up wondering if it's worth it. Mm. If you can manage to connect with and stay in touch with an audience that you yourself believe in, that can provide a continuing sense of purpose. But if you don't have a strong sense of yourself as an artist, you'll give up and move on to something else. And this book, really, Jim, is the story of him finding out how to get that audience that he believed in and believed in him back. It's eventually that same, you know, I think of a place he played a lot, and he talks about in this book, the Birchmere, right? You and I have been there many times. And what does that room hold? I don't know, 300-400 people, something like that, maybe. I mean,
sounds about right.
It was him finding that size audience in the towns where he could play and then building it up and making the record for those people that, you know, would always buy his albums and were his supporters. And it's just such a refreshing take of reality on the life in the music business. At one point, he's doing his own booking, and he's like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. It's so much harder than songwriting. Like, booking a band and keeping all these details straight is driving me crazy. I mean, he went through like 6 different managers, and then he puts a list of all the songs. You know, he's very honest about the fact that, hey, you know, I'd put like 5 or 6 really good songs on these albums that I really loved, and the rest, I just had to fill them out, you know, because albums is what I put out. So
yeah,
I just find it so refreshing and so interesting that someone's written an autobiography that's so frank and unvarnished. And it's really a very fascinating take on what it takes to make it as a musician. And again, like he said, we're not talking about Bruce Dickinson level success with Iron Maiden. I mean, it's Steve Forbert in his car with his guitar driving to play these, you know, 200-300 person shows and just trying to keep his head above water. And unfortunately, his marriage disintegrates through it. And it's a very difficult thing for him, you know, trying to be a dad to boys when he's on the road. It's just very honest. And one more quick thing I'll read to close out. This kind of, I thought, summed it up really nicely. One thing I love about the Kindle, by the way, I may have mentioned this before, you can just highlight passages and send it in a file to your email for later. But one thing I picked out here was, Steve writes, quote, after the rocket-like beginning of my career, clearly I made some mistakes. A lot of people reading this book probably feel like they've made some mistakes too. Perhaps they think, if I'd only known then what I know now. Of course, I understand that, but I couldn't have written the carefree songs or been carefree enough to write the more serious songs if I'd known then what I know now. So I wouldn't have much in the here and now to show for the there and then.
Huh.
And I think that's so smart, right? I mean, you've got to live a certain way, you know, and he understands all this. It's just really, really interesting. So I can't recommend it highly enough. It's one of my favorite books I've read in a long time.
Wow.
And I just came in not expecting anything at all. You know, I just thought this is going to be, you know, thing I'll flip through and just sort of, you know, enjoy for a little bit. And maybe I'll pick up a few, you know, quotes, anecdotes here and there and learn a little bit more about his music. I just found it to be so excellent. So again, it's called Big City Cat, My Life in Folk Rock. And written by Steve Forbert with edited by Therese Boyd.
I think that is
very good.
I think that's great. And I think it's a great lesson for people. I think what you find, I'm sure this is true about other creative endeavors too, but I think you do find that the musicians who maybe didn't have as much success, didn't become, you know, household names or rock stars, are more open and honest about their experiences.
Yeah.
You know, whereas probably Mick Jagger is never going to truly let you know
exactly
what happened in his life, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's a great example, Jim. I mean, I've read the Keith Richards book and it's like that. It's sort of an idealized portrait of, you know, all these things. He sort of just glosses over the fact that he almost died 3 or 4 times from heroin overdoses.
Right.
So, I mean, it's crazy.
So you want the real story about what the music business is like. You find a book like this.
Yeah. And I'll tell you one thing that's very interesting. I think Steve Forbert, like Springsteen and others, was tagged with that, that new Dylan label, and and it haunted him for a while. And, you know, obviously Bruce made it very successful. Now, one person that really helped Steve stabilize his career a little bit later on is Gary Talent, the bass player for the E Street Band. So he plays on 2 albums that kind of got the momentum going again for Steve Forbert and produced them as well and helped Steve pay for some of the studio costs. That's so it's cool. It's pretty cool to read that part as well.
That's cool.
But throughout the book, the one guy Steve Forbert points to that he's like, there's only one person I know who's remained an iconoclast, followed his own path completely, and never, you know, was on this massive selling major label. And that person is John Prine. And it's very, very interesting that Steve sort of, you know, holds him in that regard. Yeah. He's like, this is a guy who went to the mat and stayed on the mat for his career. And it's kind of cool.
That's great. Yeah. And I can see some of the similarities, right, in terms of
totally
their experiences. So that's really cool.
Yeah. So I would definitely recommend this one. Right. Of the three books I mentioned, they're all very good, but definitely if you get a chance and you're interested in something like this, the Steve Forbert book is very, very fun to read.
All right, cool. So three recommendations. Get busy, people. You got time.
That's right.
Right.
Get reading.
That's right.
And my next big challenge will be to finish Ulysses. Now, that's a book I've started four times and never been able to get through it. So
I think that's a common situation, right?
That is a tough read.
Okay. All right. Let's get out of here. We'll do book number Sounds again good. At some point in the future, I'm sure.
I'll keep reading.
So these books were 1966 and the Bruce Dickinson book. What was that one called again?
What does this button do?
There you go. And then the Steve Forbert book.
That's right. Big City Cat.
All right, cool. All right, check those out. And what else? Anything else? Is that about it?
No, I think that's it for now. Yeah, I appreciate the chance to talk about these books and hope somebody finds one they enjoy. Right. And if you read a book that you want to let me know about, definitely hit us up on the social medias at Suburbs Pod or send us a note on the hotline there. And you can email us too, rock@suburbspod.com. I'll take any recommendations.
Yep. Email rock@suburbspod.com or leave a message 612-440-1984. Let's do that. Okay. Let's get out of here. Okay. Let's move on to whatever is tomorrow's episode. I'm not really sure right now, but we'll figure it out. We got 24 hours. So Rock in the Suburbs, I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
I'll talk to you guys later.
It's King and Queen and we must go down now beyond the chandelier where I won't have to speak my mind and you won't have to hear shreds of news and afterthoughts and complicated scenes. We'll weather down behind the light and fade like magazines.
You know, I have the day job. I have this podcast. But other than that, I'm like pretty good at like watching TV, you know.
Yeah.